I'd like to bring together some of the themes of this last 2 weeks. And I can best do it by just commenting on an article which I wrote under the heading Signposts for Christians Among Muslims in the Secular Age. I was asked to write this essay on Islam for a book of essays which are on the essays are on the subjects which the bishops at the Lambeth Conference next month, a conference held once every 10 years of Anglican bishops around the world, 800 of them now, they wanted to have some of the evangelicals wanted to have some thought out positions on the issues that would be coming up. Islam is one, homosexuality is another, and there are other subjects which relate to our modern time. Jim Packer is one of the writers, the essayists, and the Archbishop of Canterbury has written a foreword. I haven't actually seen it out, the published book, but it came out last month, and so I'm given you my draft. So it probably in the final form in the book has a few editorial changes, but things that are small. I called it Signposts because Christ is a sign for both Muslims and Christians. The word sign comes in the Quran and in the Bible. And I was trying to look into the 21st century and see what kind of trends there are and how leaders in the churches and any who wish may focus as we look into a new century. And so these are the topics which I thought would be relevant. And you can look up in the Quran in chapter or Surah 19 and verse 21, and you will read that God wished to appoint Jesus as a sign unto men and a mercy for us. In another verse in Surah 21, verse 91, it says, "And we made her and her son a sign to the worlds, Mary and Jesus, Mary and her son." Simeon in the Bible also talks about Jesus as a sign. And you remember it is written in Luke chapter 2 and verses 30 to 32. "This child is destined to cause the falling and rising of many in Israel and to be a sign which will be spoken against, so that the thoughts out of many hearts will be revealed, and a sword will pierce your own heart, own soul too. He will be a sign, according to the Bible, spoken against." And his approaching death, I think, became something that caused people to, certainly the disciples, to reveal who they were. Judas revealed who he was. And there's in great events or happenings or in sudden crisis, you get the bottom line of what the person is like. Anyway, Christ has a significant place in the Quran and the Bible, and he is spoken of as a sign. I'd like to make a few comments on fundamentalism. We've only touched on it here and there and read about it, but the thing that strikes me most is the complexity of it. And we shouldn't have a stereotyped view of a fundamentalist. Fundamentalists are sometimes people of peace, and they're not all terrorists. It will be a very small percentage which are terrorists in their approach. And I like to think of fundamentalism, which is often changing its shape. I think of it as sometimes when you look up at the clouds in the sky, you see a cloud change its shape and where it's going. And what fundamentalism was 5 years ago, it is not now. And it is not one thing, but 1,000 things. So it's I don't think we can nail it down. I've been encouraged in my ministry to see fundamentalists who have been terrorist ones changed. I suppose you could say that Saul of Tarsus was a terrorist. At least he was going to Damascus to haul people out of their homes and put them in prison and possibly kill some of them because they followed Jesus. That comes pretty near to it. I met a fundamentalist once in a Christian home in a Muslim country, and he and his brother had been brought up as terrorists. At the age of 9, they had been taken from their homes and trained to be terrorists. And so this changed my ideas about even terrorists into fundamentalism, because what chance if you're taken at 9 and trained for a life of it? He and his cousin were on alert, studying in another university in another country, but on call for the Middle East in case there was some need for their terrorist services. And one of these two boys was, they both were welcomed into this Christian family and home, and any time they could come. And when I was staying as a guest in this Christian home, they came. And that's when I got to know this particular boy. He asked me what I did. I said I was a writer. And he asked me what I wrote. So I showed him the commentary on Romans that I was working on, which some of which comes in that book, Bible Studies for Inquirers and New Believers. Then he asked me, he said, "Can I ask you a question, another question? Are you married?" And I said, "Well, before I answer that, can I ask you a question?" Oh, yes, he asked me, "Why aren't you married?" So I said, "Before I answer, I'd like to ask you a question. Why aren't you married?" He said, "I'm on special duty." And so I said, "Well, so am I." The complexity of fundamentalism. The media gives us the sensational, but there are so many very polite and decent fundamentalists, men and women, going back to the basics of their faith. And then post-modernity, a challenge for both Muslims and Christians. And we have been studying that, and I don't think I need to say anything else. Women's rights and feminism in Islam. Again, we've done quite a bit of study on that, and so I won't say anything. But the fourth section of my essay is on the question of mission, winning the world. Christians are seeking to win the world for Christ, and Muslims are seeking to win the world for Allah. The first surah, in the first verse, God is described as Lord of the worlds. We have no problem with that concept, except that our model of God is of a Trinitarian God. And the Muslim's model of it, our model is of a Unitarian God. We do not take the approach, the same approach to mission. The Muslim agenda for world mission is very different from the Christian agenda. And the Muslim agenda is that the world is at the moment in two sections: the house of Islam, or the house of those who submit to God, and then the house of war, the house of the section of the world which is yet to come under the rule of Islam and have yet to become Muslim. So the former, the house of Islam, consists of those parts of the world ruled by Muslims and under Sharia or Islamic law, thereby submitting to God. The latter has yet to be brought into submission to God. Ideally, there is one God, one community, one Sharia. So it's incumbent on Muslims to work for this one world. In their world view, no divisions between religion and politics, or between sacred and secular. It's a unity. The mission of Islam is called Dawah, I don't pronounce the Arabic correctly, but that's basically it. Basically, this Arabic word means call, a call to Muslims to be truly Muslim. It can also mean invitation, an invitation to those outside the community of Islam to embrace Islam. In specialized usage, it means missionary activity. So it's not surprising that Muslim leaders have a concerted strategy to make each continent Muslim. For example, the headquarters of the Islamic Council of Europe, based in London, coordinates all Islamic centres and organisations in Europe, working in close cooperation with international Islamic organisations and governments of all Muslim countries. Saudi Arabia, the religious centre of Islam, possesses a quarter of the known oil resources of the world and generously finances the Voice of Islam, the world's most powerful radio transmitter. Also in Saudi, the world's largest printing works produce over 28 million copies of the Quran every year. And now the internet is becoming another way of strengthening and spreading Islam. Project Cafe Medina is a scheme to link all mosques and Islamic schools in the UK to each other and to the internet. And Dr. Ghaisuddin commented on it, "The Muslim community must be at the cutting edge of technology, not on the back seat. I want to see our children, become at one with the internet and all the tools that are necessary to comprehend this new, massively expanding medium of communication." A similar project, like Cafe Medina, has begun in Singapore. In Iran, one computer firm has an outward annual output capacity for 6 million audio and video CDs, as well as CD-ROMs for computers, and hopes to double this soon. It is reported that orders to produce 600,000 audio discs with verses of the Quran for the domestic and export markets have already been received. In Egypt, the intellectual centre of the Muslim world, the Al-Azhar University, continues to train missionaries from most Muslim countries. For all the lands of the world, for the world to be Muslim would be the Muslim view of success. And then we have here from a quotation, the Christian agenda, world mission, the Lord of heaven and earth, Acts 17, verse 24. And I don't think I need to explain the Christian agenda and world mission. As I look into the 21st century, I feel convinced that there will be increasing persecution of Christians. Persecution of Christians has been and is increasingly a stern reality in the 20th century. More believers have been martyred for their faith in Jesus Christ as Lord and Saviour in this century than in all the previous 19 centuries combined. We do have to remember that the population of the world is much larger now. But most of this persecution has taken place under Islamic rule. Generally, Muslims have perceived religious freedom as freedom to become Muslim and not as freedom to leave Islam. It is difficult for them to conceive of anyone wanting to leave the household of Islam. So it is that Muslims who have sought to confess faith in Jesus Christ as Lord have faced persecution and sometimes death. And there are many examples today from Indonesia, Pakistan, Egypt, the Sudan, and other places. The Sudan, since 1982, it is estimated that 300,000 Sudanese Christians have been killed. And when the Archbishop of Canterbury visited there, in 1994, he tried to understand this situation. The Sudanese Christian leaders urged believers around the world to pray. "We need your prayer support so that we may be able to love those who cause our sufferings and show them that the love of Christ is a stronger weapon than those used against us." Another thing that is happening now and will increase to happen is that there is, in as far as organized interfaith action is concerned, it is more than dialogue, it is more than individuals talking to each other. There are now institutions talking to each other. In recent years, interfaith networking has prospered. For example, there are new links between the Centre for the Study of Islam and Christianity at Selly Oak Colleges, Birmingham, and the Royal Institute for Interfaith Studies in Amman, Jordan. Other links are through exchange of lecturers and students. I find this one particularly interesting. In 1996, Dr. Anara, who is a lecturer in history at the Kyrgyz National University, held a fellowship in Birmingham at the Selly Oak Colleges. She's a Muslim. She's director of the Kyrgyz Peace Research Center in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan. She has a particular interest in Christian-Muslim relations and spent considerable time at the Center for the Study of Islam and Christianity. She wrote into the center's newsletter, "Since the fall of the Soviet Union in August 1991, life in Kyrgyzstan has greatly changed. The Declaration of Freedom of Religions for All Peoples has laid the groundwork for a religious renaissance, mainly Islamic and Christian. Kyrgyzstan has just entered into the world community as a free and independent country. The need to promote democracy as well as peaceful resolutions in the area is of utmost importance. It would be far more costly in terms of energy and material means to compensate for the consequences of a conflict than to prevent it. The Kyrgyz Peace Research Center intends to create a model which will provide recommendations for the prevention of religious and ethnic tensions, helping to maintain multi-faith peace within Kyrgyzstan. This NGO, non-government organization, has two main programs, one on research on ethno-religious development and another on civic education." She sees this gap, vacuum and the possibilities. It can make things much worse, but it could, if people of different faiths and no faith cooperate, it could reduce tension and ethnic trouble. The visit of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. George Carey, to the Al-Azhar University in Cairo in October 1995 was widely reported in both the Egyptian and British press. It's remarkable that he should be invited to lecture there, and the centre can give you the full text of what he said. But what he, in very great detail, in broad summary, I should say, he said, he listed some attitude-transforming statements which are a challenge to us all. He counselled friendship and not hostility, understanding not ignorance, reciprocity, I find this difficult to say, anyway, not exclusivism, and cooperation, not confrontation, in all our relationships. In speaking about cooperation, he noted that Muslims and Christians share a common witness against secularism as a system which defines life, knowledge and culture without any reference to what lies beyond life. He advocated cooperation in fighting poverty and human misery and in promoting peace and harmony among peoples with tolerance and understanding. And then in the seventh section, I have made some comments which might be of help to the church. Listening, clergy and laity, listening, understanding and interacting with Muslims. A new situation calls for a fresh look at how the church prepares for its ministry. I hope it will become a matter of further discussion in the church, wherever it is found. These few recommendations have arisen from discussions with Asians, Africans and Europeans, and North Americans, I should say, that Islamics be taught in Christian seminaries and Bible colleges through the world. Arabic could also be offered. at least on an optional basis. Suitable people should be encouraged and enabled to study and research on Islam and related subjects for doctorates. That in the UK, more Christians should try to learn one of the languages used by the minority ethnic groups. And fourthly, that more Christians should be aware of the value of video, satellite TV and the internet in listening to and communicating with Muslims. It has recently been observed that Islamic groups have been quick to exploit the potential of news groups on the internet, and in doing so have given Christians an excellent resource, the chance to watch them in action, to learn firsthand what they really think and feel, not that what they think, well, not what we think they think and feel. A June 1996 report from a nation country in which Muslims are 12% minority and Christians an even smaller minority says, "One miserable problem we Muslim converts face here is non-acceptance in the churches. Muslims mostly live in a close-knit society, very dependent upon one another. After conversion, we experience loneliness as our society totally rejects us. And on the other hand, we're always treated with passiveness and indifference by the majority of Christians when we try to share with them. It took an Ananias for the Apostle Paul to be accepted in Jerusalem, and a Barnabas and a Lydia to encourage him in his ministry. Things have not changed much." And then I conclude, well, come near to concluding, by asking, is there going to be another epiphany? Epiphany was the revealing of Christ to the Gentiles. So what about the revealing of Christ to the Muslims? What about the harvest to come? The revealing of Christ to the Gentiles. The revealing of Christ to the Gentiles was unexpected, far more widespread and extensive than anyone foresaw. It was mind-boggling and changed the face of the Hebrew church. The difficulties in accepting it and the contextualization called for resulted in the Council of Jerusalem. God's preparation for the coming in of the Gentiles involved elements which can be paralleled today. The intertestament Jewish dispersion can be compared with the modern dispersions in the Middle East resulting from the discovery of oil. Because of these dispersions, more people are living in the Arabian Peninsula than in any time in the history of the church. And Arabia is the centre, religiously, of Islam. And Egypt is the intellectual centre of Islam, affecting the whole Islamic world, Muslims everywhere. Whatever the restrictions, wherever God's people are, his spirit is active through them. Economic and political factors have also contributed to large dispersions of Muslims in the Western countries. Muslims and Christians have more opportunity to greet each other than ever before. And secondly, Greek was the universal language at the time of Christ. Compare with this with the, and so it was ready because of the dispersion and these parents in Alexandria and so on saying we need a today's Greek version of the Old Testament. That was already in place when the disciples spread the gospel. But compare this universal language at the time of Christ, Greek, with the increasing use of English today and the widespread use of modern media in ways of communicating the gospel. And then, most important perhaps of all, the sovereign acts of God in miracles, visions, dreams of Christ, and a hunger and increasing demand for the Bible. Greater demand for the Bible in Arabic-speaking countries than ever. And then satellite TV, the vision of Sat7, that in every country of the Arab-speaking world, 21 countries, there will be a 24-hour program through every day, every night, Christian program, so that it can be the message of Christ in different ways will be communicated. And I would conclude, we live in a very exciting time in the history of the world. The great opportunity of the church in our time is to be what it is called to be, especially in regard to Muslims. Let one of the martyrs have the last word. Such a spirit cannot be defeated. Wherever the grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it brings forth much fruit. Father Christian de Cherge was one of the 7 Trappist monks killed by the Algerian terrorists in May 1996. In the translation from the French of his last testament to be opened in the event of my death, we read, I could not desire such a death. I do not see, in fact, how I could rejoice if this people, the Algerian people, whom I love, were to be accused indiscriminately of my murder. It would be to pay too dearly for what will perhaps be called the grace of martyrdom. To owe it to an Algerian, whoever he may be, especially if he says he's acting in fidelity to what he believes to be Islam. I know the scorn with which Algerians as a whole can be regarded. I also know the caricature of Islam, which a certain kind of idealism encourages. It would be too easy to give oneself a good conscience by identifying this religious way with the fundamentalist ideologists of the extremists. For me, Algeria and Islam are something different. They are a body and a soul. And you also, the friend of my final moment, who would not be aware of what you were doing, I wish to commend you to God, whose face I see in yours, and may we find one another happy, good thieves in paradise, if it pleases God, the Father of us both. Amen.